Good evening to everybody. The program is off the hook. A bit of a rough landing there. This is Emmanuel, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yo.
And over in Skype land, we've got Alex.
Good evening.
And we've got Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
And we have Gila.
Hello.
Well, what a week this has been. It's March 10th, 2021. I guess if you called it anything, it's the week of security lapses and violations and things like that. We've got a lot to get into, a lot of follow-up for things that we've been discussing. And, of course, we have overtime coming up at 8 o'clock on our YouTube channel. That's channel 2600. And you can get the exact link by clicking on the icon at the top of 2600.com and just wait over there. Because you can make phone calls. The phone number, by the way, for later, for 8 o'clock, is 802-321-4225. It's 802-321-HACK. And you can call us and tell us what you're up to, how you've been experiencing the pandemic, if you've been able to get a vaccine. We've been helping a lot of people get vaccinations with different systems, New York, New Jersey, places like that. And people are getting them. I got mine last week. I know, Rob and Gila, you got yours last week as well. Quite an experience. I had it out on Long Island and got to see the National Guard directing traffic. And it was, you know, for the most part, pretty calm and collected and organized. And really felt kind of proud seeing everybody coming together like that. And I continue to feel proud seeing people following the guidelines, wearing masks, keeping distance, taking care of each other while this thing plays out. And it is playing out. We're getting to the end of this, but we'll get there if we all continue to think logically and follow the science, because everything that we have been told as far as what to expect has come true. You know, when the peaks will be, when things will go down, when things will get better, when things will get worse, what kind of behavior will cause problems, how the holidays affect things, it all has played out exactly as predicted. So when people tell us that there's going to be a lot more availability of the vaccine in the weeks ahead, I believe them. And I think by summer, we will be well on the way to normalcy, unless stupidity reigns. And of course, if stupidity reigns, then anything is possible.
It's all about adhering to just the basic stuff and still living your life and having a little bit of fun, but in the basic steps, not really backing away from as much as it's taken to get to the point where we're at, where there is tremendous excitement for the possibility of doing what were really simple things, I guess, a year ago. Mm-hmm. To the day or this week, yeah.
I should point out that I'm kind of on call as far as something might beep or buzz or ring, and it might involve a vaccine that becomes available that I need to help somebody with. So if that happens, I might have to duck out for a few minutes.
Yeah, the schedules don't wait, do they?
They don't, and it's possible that will happen during the show because that is just how Murphy's Law works. But you guys, Rob, Miguel, any feedback you want to give? How have you felt after your vaccine, by the way?
I feel like feeling fine. I was tired the day after, but that was it. And, you know, it's been a week and feeling great.
Yeah, same. I felt like I had a mild cold the next day, and it cleared up by the afternoon. So really, I couldn't feel better about this whole thing.
I felt a little tired, and I had this mysterious ache right where they inserted the needle for about a day. Still haven't figured out what caused that. But it's gone now, and feel fine. Which vaccine did you get, by the way?
Pfizer.
Pfizer's, same here. Pfizer represent. Wow.
Okay,
that's
okay.
Great.
Well, let's
You can take pride in your vaccine, Kyle. Maybe you'll be a Johnson & Johnson. I don't know.
I just think it gives the wrong idea, but that's good. There's some affinity in the group.
They
here.
Gave me a flag, okay? So I intend to use it.
Flying the Pfizer colors.
Yes. Alex, go ahead.
Well, I feel like, you know, you guys have all disclosed that you got your vaccines. I can disclose I got mine too.
Good. Okay. I'm glad we can finally reveal that happened. Tell us your experience.
Yeah. My experience was a little bit different from yours. I got the Moderna vaccine. I was happy to get it. I got it in Pennsylvania, you know, fairly recently. And, you know, it really did kick my butt for a while. I mean, not that the injection itself didn't hurt really whatsoever, but I was very fatigued later on that night. I had a pain in my arm for about 3 or 4 days, and not just a regular pain, you know, like something was injected in you and, oh, that's pain, but, you know, deep soreness in my shoulder to the point where it was very difficult for me to lift my arm over my shoulder, right? So to go higher than my head with my arm. That hurt. And then the second day of the vaccine, I was not only really tired, but I also had the chills that night, and then the sweats, and then the chills, and then the sweats. And so, yeah, I was running a fever. After that, I was perfectly fine. And I was happy to endure all of that for the privilege of obtaining the vaccine and having that measure of security and normalcy, hopefully returning back to life soon.
And we are in no way implying that just because you got the Moderna vaccine, we're not looking down, guys. We're Pfizer's. We're not looking down on you in any way. So don't feel like we are, because, Alex, we're not. I promise. We're not doing that. And we're not saying that you had all those side effects as a result of you getting that vaccine instead of the one that the rest of us got. So don't feel that way.
That's right.
They're all as good. They all will combat the disease.
Well, you know, as an Oxonian, I think that the Oxford vaccine is probably going to be better than all of them. So, you know.
The main idea, though, is that when they offer you a vaccine, if you get the chance to have a vaccine, get the vaccine. Don't worry about picking flavors like you're at the soda fountain in Burger King. Any one of the vaccines available will help you. It will help the people around you. It will help this whole herd immunity thing we need to get going. And it's all of our responsibilities to just get on that as soon as we can.
Yeah, and while you're at the soda fountain at Burger King, you know, don't dawdle there either. Because why are we at a soda fountain in Burger King? Is that where they are now? What happened to the independent ones? My God.
All right. Well, let's continue vaccinating the airwaves here at WBAI.
Yeah, that's good. I like that.
Where you can always become a WBAI buddy.
So this is an interesting story. This is, I think, the one story that doesn't have to do with a security breach. It has to do with a release of information, however, though. Last Thursday, New York City's civilian police watchdog released a searchable database of complaints made against current and former NYPD officers. Much of the information contained in the Civilian Complaint Review Board's database was made last summer by the NYCLU, New York Civil Liberties Union. Release of records marks the first time a city or state agency has made such a database available in compliance with last summer's repeal of 50A. That's the state law that had long shielded police misconduct records from public scrutiny. The repeal was vehemently opposed by law enforcement unions, our favorite people, which have spent the intervening months challenging the decision in court and throwing all kinds of temper tantrums. The database's launch comes right after the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit said the release of disciplinary records for police officers, corrections officers, and firefighters could begin immediately. Now, this database includes information on 34,811 active NYPD officers and 48,218 inactive officers with complaints dating back to 2000. That's a lot of complaints. I would have guessed that's how many officers there were, but boy, a lot of complaints against these people. Details about each complaint are limited to the incident date, the type of complaint, which is force, abuse of authority, discourtesy, offensive language, a one or two word description of the allegation, and whether the complaint was substantiated. Unlike the NYCLU's database and a smaller one published by ProPublica, information on the CCRB site will be updated on a daily basis. This seems like a golden light onto democracy, onto revealing actual information.
It's just basic public interest oversight and probably long overdue in a lot of cases. And there's really interesting stuff in here. You want to know, are there officers or groups of officers that tend toward many of these violations? Like, is each one of these a violation, or it's not different officers, but how many groups, how many times and how many different officers were involved in different incidents, and what kinds of patterns of behavior, and how can you associate that with other information? It's important.
Yeah, and you know, whereas in the past, this information was kept completely secret. You couldn't even find out somebody's name who was involved in some kind of crime or abuse or something like that. Yes, go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, to bounce off Kyle's point, too, I think this is a real victory for the civilian oversight of the police. You know, and that's just a fundamental principle that we have in this country. The military has civilian oversight by the commander-in-chief. The commander-in-chief is somebody who is a civilian. The president is a civilian. And overseeing the military, we should have a high degree of transparency and civilian oversight of our local police forces. And so anything that contributes to that sort of transparency, I think we can all get behind and be a proponent of. You know, my understanding, too, is that with the release of this data, it will be in a format that it's not easy to completely digest all of it. Like we were talking last week about the Gab leaks with Zan and Emma from Distributed Denial of Secrets, which was such an awesome show, by the way. If they're listening, thank you guys so much for being on. But that's a different type of data. That's a huge amount of data that can be analyzed really quickly. I think this type of data hopefully will be put up in such a way that the data can be easily digested and downloaded and then analyzed for corresponding data points like Kyle was suggesting. I think that's going to be really, really interesting. And the other thing I'm personally curious about is, I complained about treatment from an officer about 2 years ago, and I'd like to see if it's in that database. And in particular, and this was an interesting anecdote. Are you interested in hearing what happened to me?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, this was the situation. I'm walking across 14th Street. And, you know, in Manhattan, so the West Village was on the south side. So, it was, you know, West Village, north side's Chelsea. And I'm there with my wife and I'm there with my child. This was actually maybe about 3 years ago now.
So this is before a bunch of cars got stricken from 14th Street.
That's correct.
They've changed 14th Street, basically.
Yeah, this is before that.
Okay.
And my son was in a stroller and we're pushing the stroller across the street. And we have the white man telling us that it's okay to walk.
Okay, well, I got to stop you right there. When you say you have the white man telling you to walk, you're talking about the crossing signal, which is a white light with a man on it. And then it turns into a red hand with a number counting down. That's at some places, not all of them.
That's some racist overlord telling me it's
no
across the street.
But yeah, please continue. So, try to avoid those kinds of references.
So, yes, I'm crossing the street going from west to east and coming from the eastbound lane on 14th Street, making a left to head south onto 7th Avenue. The avenue that I was crossing was a police officer in a canine unit truck. And the white lit up man is telling us it's totally okay to cross. We're going. We got a stroller. We're trying to get a move on. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this cop who's making a left-hand turn rolls down his window and starts screaming at us and screaming expletives. Get the F out of the way. What are you doing? Come on, move it. And I couldn't believe it. I could not believe that we were being treated this way by some random cop who wanted to make a left.
Two questions. Yeah. And obviously, he was in a car. You had the light. You had the white man or whatever you want to call it, or maybe it was turning red by then. But you still had the light. Was his siren or his flashing lights on or anything like that?
No, his lights were not flashing. He just was in a hurry to make a left. He didn't want to miss the light because if the more pedestrians that cross, the less likely you are to make that light.
Wait. A cop was worried about missing a light? I've never heard of that.
Well, you know, I'm speculating as to why he was in such a hurry, because like you said, his lights were not on. Uh-huh. He didn't seem to have any other sense of urgency. There wasn't any kind of emergency situation. And yet here he is screaming and yelling.
Hang on. Gila has a question. Go ahead.
Gila has a question. So you said it was a canine unit, right?
Wait,
canine
unit, a canine unit.
Maybe the dog pooped in the car. He needed to deal with poop.
Don't help the cops, Gila. Don't help the cop with alibis.
I'm just speculating.
That's their job. Let them do it.
Yeah, leave the dog out of this.
And don't blame the dog. It's always the dog's fault, right? I'm sorry. Continue, Alex.
So in any event, you know, I don't really know what to do at this point because, you know, I hear somebody yelling and screaming at us. I look up and I see it's a cop. And I think to myself, what in the world is going on here? You know, this is crazy. You know, and it was also sort of emasculating, too, because here's a guy that, you know, not only has a vicious dog in the back, he has the authority to arrest you, and he's armed. So ordinarily, I would yell back at this person, tell him where to get off, you know, whatever. I have Sicilian blood in me, so I've got a bit of a hot temper. But when it comes to a police officer yelling at you like this, it was a little bit emasculating for me because there's really not much you can do. You just take it, right? You just hurry up across the street because he thinks he can completely act with impunity. So I was so mad about the situation that I called up 311 and I went through the whole process of filing an official complaint. And then somebody followed up with me about this, but I didn't have the exact unit number of the vehicle. So they're trying to figure out who was going south on 7th Avenue, crossing 14th Street at that particular time. And I requested follow-up several times from the 311 system or the NYPD, and I never heard anything. So I'm very curious as to whether or not that complaint is in there.
Well, how are you ever going to find, if you don't know the guy's name, and I assume you don't know the dog's name, I don't know if dogs are even included in this database, how would they ever find, I guess the canine unit, they might be able to eliminate the number of cops in that region at that particular time of day, I would bet against it for that kind of a thing.
You would think with all of the geolocation tracking that's involved in traversing Manhattan these days, they would be able to locate one of their own canine units at a specific place in time in the city that they are charged with policing. You would think that. Right? So that's why I found it particularly incredulous that I didn't hear any follow-up about this whatsoever.
Go ahead, Rob.
Well, one thing you can do with this database, and like you said, it is a real win for the Civilian Complaints Review Board, which is baked into the city charter as civilian oversight of the NYPD. And so it's good to see them actually get the ability to accomplish things like this. You can look things up by the officer's name. You can look things up by the officer's shield number, the badge number, which is especially interesting if, like me, you tend to keep tabs on when protests are going on, political actions, things like that. And there come up photographs or video footage of police officers behaving badly, let's say. And you can now look that up and not only look up the badge number and get the complaints, but look up the badge number, see which officer this is without going to further trouble. And this is hosted on nyc.gov. It is a part of the city.
Right, we're going to give you the URL in just a second, but first these caveats. The database reflects CCRB complaints only. That's Civilian Complaint Review Board, only their complaints. Allegations of misconduct that fall outside of their jurisdiction are not included in that database. The New York City Charter specifies that the CCRB's jurisdiction includes four categories of police misconduct: force, abuse of authority, discourtesy, that's you, Alex, and offensive language. That's also you. You got two of them.
Yeah, that's right. I got it.
CCRB allegation history does not include open allegations, successfully mediated allegations, or mediation attempted allegations. CCRB allegation history does not include allegations from complaints filed prior to the year 2000. It also does not include referrals to the NYPD or other investigative entities. In the modules in this included in this database, FADO type refers to where the allegation fits within the CCRB's FADO jurisdiction. Anybody want to guess what FADO stands for? No? Okay. Force, abuse of authority, discourtesy, and offensive language. I just said it, so they have an acronym for it. There is a significant difference between the CCRB dispositions exonerated, unfounded, and unsubstantiated. When exploring the database, please refer to the definitions of the CCRB's case outcomes. With that, the URL is the following, www.nyc.gov/site/ccrb/policy/M-O-S-records.page. You know what? That's too much. You expect people to remember that? Because if you don't have the capitals in there, it doesn't work. All right. So what we did right before the show is we made a tiny URL for you. tinyurl.com/NYPD-database. That's much easier, right? Lowercase. Perfect. Lowercase. Just do that instead. NYPD-database. Have fun. Enjoy yourself and look up whatever it is you want to look up. That's what we're about, spreading information.
Yeah. The important thing is you have this as a resource now. Mm-hmm. And that's it's important to recognize and find out what this can, how we can help and benefit from this information now. What ways will it be used, and how do we get it out there to the right people?
Exactly.
So that's really cool.
That's what Off the Hook is about. That's
hopefully, we'll about. Yeah, absolutely. That's what we've always been
what
about.
What hackers have been about? Yes, Alex, go ahead.
And my understanding as well is that there will be some kind of NYPD database that will eventually come online. But at the time that this database went live, the NYPD said it wasn't yet available to be made live. So I think there will be more data coming.
Yeah, because they delay as much as possible. And I heard that their database, when it does become available, it'll look like baseball cards. In fact, that's how they're going to present their officers, as if they're on baseball cards, which is fine. You know, spread the information however you want to do it. But as far as getting to the actual truth, I would trust the CCRB.
I think you mean Little League cards.
I'm not going to say, but they're not out yet, though. Okay, so to the breaches, because we have a lot of security issues to deal with tonight that we really should get into. And first and foremost, a threat actor has hacked into the social media account of South Korea's biggest boy band, BTS, also known as the Bangtan Boys. The seven-member band joined TikTok in 2019 and has since... wait a minute, why did this make it to the top of the list? This is hardly the most important thing that happened. I'm sorry about this. I'm looking at the TikTok messages or whatever. It's pretty shocking, but deal with it, guys. Your TikTok got hacked. I'm sorry. That's not the story I wanted to read. Microsoft Exchange. Yeah, that should have been at the top. This is something that's pretty huge. Since early January, the signs have been here. For this particular exploit. Now, Microsoft announced last week that its widely used email server program had been hacked. And since then, experts are not encouraged by what they have found. According to Katie Nichols, the director of intelligence at the cybersecurity firm Red Canary, in short, it's gotten really messy. We are seeing no signs of this slowing down. The cybersecurity community sprang into action after Microsoft first announced a series of vulnerabilities that let hackers, or perhaps we should say intruders, break into the company's Exchange email and calendar programs that are used by hundreds of thousands of companies around the world. China has used it to spy on a wide range of industries in the United States, ranging from medical research to law firms to defense contractors. China has denied responsibility. Maybe we don't say China. Maybe we don't say hackers. Maybe we just simply say intruders, because, you know, it could be anybody. And that's what this is increasingly pointing to. Now, Microsoft's announcement has complicated the situation with efforts to fix the flaws appearing to have drawn more intruders to exploit organizations that haven't yet updated the software. Nichols said she'd seen indications 5 different hacker groups whose identities are unknown were now exploiting it. Well, their identities are unknown. I'm not sure how we know they're hacker groups, but whatever. The list of victims is growing. According to Ben Reed, director of threat analysis at the cybersecurity company Mandiant, it's big. We're above 40 incidents we're responding to, just current customers we have. We're at over 500 likely victims based on confirmation of likely sources. Now, while there was no official public list of victims, the full tally is definitely in the tens of thousands. There's definitely a lot of small, medium-sized entities. That's the customer base of Exchange. Now, there have been no reports so far that any government agencies have been affected. The U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, the country's primary cybersecurity agency, today exercised its emergency powers to force government agencies to update to the latest version of Exchange. I'd like to see that memo. In an unusually candid message, the agency then tweeted Monday evening that CISA, Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, urges all CAPS organizations across all CAPS, again, sectors to follow guidance to address the widespread domestic and international exploitation of Microsoft Exchange server product vulnerabilities. Now, the hack started quietly as a more surgical operation. Initially, the intruders exploiting Exchange were the ones Microsoft identified as Chinese spies sometime around the beginning of the year, the beginning of January. Near the end of January, the cybersecurity company Vlexity noticed that hackers were spying on two of its customers and alerted Microsoft so it could begin working on a fix in its next Exchange software update. Keep in mind the amount of time that has passed here. Now, Vlexity President Stephen Adair said that they were using that explicitly to steal emails. It was under the radar. And he said, after he told Microsoft, he noticed a change in the hackers' activity. They seemed to realize a patch was coming, so they moved from stealthily reading emails to trying to create footholds to stay in their victims' networks, which made them far more visible to cybersecurity defenders. You don't care if they're noisy because you're trying to beat a patch. That's what he said of their strategy. You found your high-priority targets. You've been stealing emails. Now you want to move on. Maybe you want to build infrastructure to launch future attacks. Hackers began frantically exploiting the Exchange vulnerabilities around the end of February, and it's escalated since. We continue to see exploitation of these vulnerabilities over the weekend. Any organization with an Exchange server needs to take it very seriously. And, I would definitely say so. If we know anybody who uses Microsoft Exchange, according to David Kennedy, CEO of cybersecurity firm Trusted Sec, he said hundreds of thousands of organizations could have been vulnerable to this hack. Anybody that had Exchange installed was potentially vulnerable. It's not every single one, but it's a large percentage of them. On the scale of 1 to 10, this is a 20, he said. Yeah, he's good with the sound bites. It was essentially a skeleton key to open up any company that had this Microsoft product installed. Fixing the problem isn't as simple as clicking an update button on a computer screen. It requires upgrading an organization's entire so-called Active Directory, which catalogs email users and their respective privileges. Taking down your email server is not something you do lightly. But, you know, something else you shouldn't do lightly is sign on to these companies that might not get security as much as they should. This is going to cost so many companies so much, and it's people laugh at us when we say we run our own mail servers. They're not laughing now. This is why people like to do things themselves and not just sign it over to a company that, when they mess up, what happens to you? Yes, Alex, go ahead.
Look, this is there's no way, I think, to overestimate this type of breach. This is totally massive. I mean, this is something that the effects of which are going to be felt for a very, very long time. Because as you mentioned, I think rather quickly in the article, there is this race to develop persistence in high-value targets as networks. So that means they had access through Exchange to certain portals, and they knew a patch was going to be coming. So what they were trying to do at that particular point was figure out how they can stay in, and that may take any kind of form. Like, there's no indicators of compromise for whatever those other forms of malicious activity are that these threat actors then use to maintain some kind of persistence in the network or otherwise make some kind of lateral move around the network. So it's not enough to just figure out, okay, our Exchange server does look like it seems to have been compromised, or it was abused by some of our cyber adversaries or threat actors, whatever you want to call them. Because then, if that is the case, if you find any kind of indicators of compromise that your Exchange server was in fact affected, then you have to begin the hunt anew to determine whether those same threat actors have any kind of additional foothold within your network. So this is extraordinarily big business for forensics firms that are going to have to respond to this. I mean, there are a lot of entities right now that are in incident response mode. But to go back to what you were saying, Emmanuel, with regard to, you know, this is why others do it. I mean, Microsoft has, I think, has been a lot better lately and has really been at the forefront and leading the charge when it comes to sharing threat intelligence and taking security seriously. But I think that this shows that there are any number of ways to compromise a system. And a belief that something is secure is particularly naive because you have a widespread event like this happening. And on the flip side of this, too, is there once the indicators of compromise were out there and there was a race to patch, I think not only Chinese cyber adversaries, but there were threat actors and organized crime groups from around the world that were trying to exploit this as quickly as possible. So in so doing, and no doubt they got there before the patches were properly installed. So in so doing, there is now, we have to assume, a great deal of private information from these various exchange servers that is floating around in the hands of adversaries. And that's information that will be exploited over time, over long periods of time, perhaps for identity theft or business email compromise or the theft of trade secrets. So I think a lot of perhaps even intelligence services were trying to exploit this as quickly as they possibly could so that they could hoover up data and use it for their own advantage. So I think, you know, there's criminal groups, there are intelligence agencies, there's a lot of other adversaries out there that probably took full advantage of this. And this is going to be a problem that's felt for a very, very long time.
Go ahead, Kyle.
I think it's valid, the critiques of services like Exchange or Outlook, if it's hosted and maybe there are other solutions you could take an interest in. But if an organization is choosing this, I think there are arguments to be made that, as Alex indicated, Microsoft is to a degree proactive in developing that product, because it is a product that they're expecting people to pay for to get updates or to have control over how they host their email. And I think the vulnerabilities, there were 4 zero-day vulnerabilities, and to a large degree, when you look at this, if you step back a little bit at and you want to give Microsoft the benefit of the doubt, there you would maybe point to the ways we're incentivizing the knowledge around 0 days and how that's marketed and even repackaged in intelligence circles and becomes valuable instead of fixed. And I think that's where hackers who talk about these things are like open with firms and, you know, have a sense of humor about it and really have the same feeling that they want products that they've essentially paid for or that we have an expectation to work. They want them to work as well and not leak our own data in the process of just simply using the stuff and so forth.
Well, you know, when you consider the first inklings of this were in early January, and here we are almost in mid-March, and it's still playing out, the response could have been better, for sure. But when you sign up for a company to trust with your private information, there's no guarantee that it's going to remain private. There's just no guarantee of that. And if you understand that when you sign up, well, then you can do it. What, you know, you can keep your own local backups, and if something like this ever happens, at least you still have your data. It might be in other people's possessions as well, but that's kind of when you sign over to Microsoft, to handle your email, you're kind of giving that away right then, because if they mess up, your private information is no longer private, period. We have to move on because we have so many other stories to get to in a very limited amount of time. A group of hackers say they breached a massive trove of security camera data collected by Silicon Valley startup Verkada Inc., gaining access to live feeds of 150,000 surveillance cameras, including hospitals, companies, police departments, prisons, schools, My God. Companies whose footage was exposed include car maker Tesla, software provider Cloudflare. In addition, hackers were able to view video from inside women's health clinics, psychiatric hospitals, and the offices of Verkada itself. Some of the cameras, including in hospitals, use facial recognition technology to identify and categorize people captured on the footage. The hackers say they also have access to the full video archive of all Verkada customers. And I apologize if I'm pronouncing Verkada wrong, but I've never encountered that word before. In a video seen by Bloomberg, where this story comes from, a Verkada camera inside Florida Hospital Halifax Health showed what appeared to be 8 hospital staffers tackling a man and pinning him to a bed. Halifax Health is featured on Verkada's public-facing website in a case study entitled How a Florida Healthcare Provider Easily Updated and Deployed a Scalable HIPAA-Compliant Security System. Another video shot inside a Tesla warehouse in Shanghai shows workers on an assembly line. The hackers say they obtained access to 222 cameras in Tesla factories and warehouses. The data breach was carried out by an international hacker collective and intended to show the pervasiveness of video surveillance and the ease with which systems could be broken into. That's according to Tilly Kotman, one of the hackers who claimed credit for breaching San Mateo, California-based Verkada. Kotman, who uses they-them pronouns, previously claimed credit for hacking chipmaker Intel Corp and carmaker Nissan Motor Company. Kotman said their reasons for hacking are lots of curiosity, fighting for freedom of information, and against intellectual property, a huge dose of anti-capitalism, a hint of anarchism, and it's also just too much fun not to do it. Okay, these are my people. So probably the best. These are hackers. That's what hackers do. They find a security hole, they reveal it, they show how vulnerable everybody is, and we learn from it. There's no profit motive here. There is simply the desire to educate. And this is huge. This is huge, being able to spy on all these cameras. And just because you're able to do it, you know, doesn't mean that there aren't thousands of other people who can do it and won't tell you. Go ahead, Rob.
And this goes back to what you were saying before about when you just hand control over something to some external company for really no good reason. I mean, security cameras are a known technology. It is basically a simple matter to get a set of security cameras, get a system to run the thing, and have that all hosted locally in your building, or, you know, even hosted somewhere else, but still somewhere under your control. You don't have to sign it over to some cloud-based company that's just going to leave you vulnerable to something like this. And especially when you're running security cameras in a place like a clinic, a hospital, all these places where privacy of the footage is paramount. I consider it an act of carelessness to even go for external providers and things like this when you can get it done yourself for probably more money, but it's worth it in the end.
But, you know, that's not to say that you can't also make yourself vulnerable by doing it yourself and not obeying security rules. For instance, if you have a security system on Wi-Fi and you use default passwords, well, anybody just driving by will be able to log into your system and spy on you on a more personal level. But this one in particular, yeah, it's very dramatic because it's one company. One company was accessed, and they have hundreds of thousands of customers, and by extension, all of them are vulnerable as well. That is the choice we make when we sign up for these massive companies who don't respect security. Alex.
One question I have about how this was done is that was all the data from Verkada going to one centralized repository that was breached by these particular hackers? You know, or were these individual breaches of security cameras? Do you know the answer to that?
I think one led to the other. I think it was a massive breach of Verkada, and then through that, you could pretty much pick and choose, because it seems that's what they're doing. They're able to access almost anything they want.
Right. Well, 2 points, you know, come to mind from that. You know, one is that if this was not a centralized breach of the Verkada system and it led to breaches of internal security cameras themselves, meaning that if you breached Verkada, you could then use Verkada as a roadmap to figure out where the other vulnerable cameras were. Most of these cameras, the way in which they work, are they're essentially web servers. They're just web servers. They're running some kind of stripped down version of Linux and Apache. Apache is a web server software that runs on Linux, open source software. And so if you're able to compromise some of these security cameras, what you have, in effect, is a compromised Linux system on somebody's network, which means that once you have a compromised Linux system on somebody's network and you have super user privileges, you're able to go in as root, you're able to install some really interesting, nasty packages, it's pretty much game over. You can do a hell of a lot of damage from a security camera. So I think, you know, the hackers here did the right thing in, you know, releasing this information out to the public so that we can begin to recover from it. But then the second point here that I wanted to make, which is quite interesting, is if you think about the backlash over the last year or so against facial recognition, all of those cities and local municipalities that have banned facial recognition and dragnet surveillance were probably spared from this particular breach. Just something to think about.
Go ahead, Rob.
And something else to think about talking of this is Donk Enby on Twitter, well-known hacker, has noted earlier today that the command, if you happen to be in a root shell on a Verkada security camera, the command kill-9$ will exit your root shell without saving the bash history, and that'll fool even Cloudflare's security response team. So wow. There is fun stuff going on with those things, but yeah, it was a massive hole left open that didn't have to be.
Okay, moving on, because we still have more stories to get to. A security breach of a different sort. A fire at a French cloud services firm has disrupted millions of websites, knocking out government agencies' portals, banks, shops, news websites, and taking out a chunk of the .fr web space. Yeah, the fire broke out earlier today at OVH Cloud, destroyed one of four data centers in Strasbourg in eastern France and damaged another. There was no immediate explanation provided for the blaze, which erupted just 2 days after the French cloud computing firm kicked off plans for an initial public offering. Europe's largest cloud services provider told clients, including the French government, the Centre Pompidou — that's a cool building, by the way — and cryptocurrency exchange Deribit to activate their disaster recovery plans following the blaze. Here's the thing. A lot of people didn't have disaster recovery plans. A lot of people had everything just stored in that data center, and now it's gone. So if you don't have a security plan for when your cloud provider disappears, you're going to be facing some hard times if something like this happens. Because, yeah, this is a fairly low-tech attack, fire, but it does happen. And it can happen to any building, any service. Kyle?
With regard to plans, we were talking earlier about this email thing. Have another way to communicate. Okay, because if you have that type of server right now, you're taking a little vacation from that. You're taking it out. It's going to go sit on the back porch and cool down. You'll put it back in and turn it back on later. And you know, they're making forensic copies of everything
now.
Not
the French. They're not cooling down. Those are not coming back up.
And then you're going to start up with some patched email servers, and everybody's going to slowly come back to that. That's what's going on, because it's ongoing. Same thing with a fire. You have a disaster recovery plan. You have to come back online slowly, but you have to have back channels and other ways to communicate with your team, with your staff, with your clients and customers, all of that, or family, you know, whatever your vital systems, whatever kinds of things you're storing in this way. When realities of technology, maybe the Bitcoin mining farm next door caught on fire or whatever, then have a problem in your digital neighborhood and have to have other ways, other forms of technology, other types of communication, that you have those lists, that stuff in advance, so that you can fall back on them as an alternative.
Well, I certainly hope OVH Cloud had their own disaster recovery system in place, where everything is stored in a different site someplace else that they can basically retrieve after all the paperwork is filled out. But in addition to that, it's on all of us as users to keep our own backups, because you never know when you'll lose all connectivity, or something will just disappear, a company goes bankrupt, or there's court orders against them. Who knows? There's all sorts of things. But this is something that I guess a lot of people didn't see coming. It is unusual. Alex?
As someone who's drafted you know, many disaster recovery plans myself, I would say, you know, it's one thing to have what looks like a great plan on paper for your particular department, but it's another thing to test it. And it's only when you test your disaster recovery plans, when you make sure that your systems can fail over, do you see whether or not you actually have that redundancy that you intended to design into the system in place. You know, because you may have redundant backups in place, but they may be with OVH or they may be with a single provider. So you really need to try to take out of the equation certain components of whatever the, you know, whatever the disaster is affecting, and make sure your disaster recovery plan can still operate. So testing, I think, is as important as drafting. And then another problem that I see with disaster recovery plans is that they're done a bit in a vacuum. You look at your department, but you may not look at other departments. Other departments may have data on which your department relies and have completely inadequate or woefully insufficient disaster recovery plans. So you have to look at this holistically. You have to test it. You have to make sure that certain things can fail over. Really important.
Yeah, what you say about testing, I think, is very important. Pretend that there is a disaster. Pretend that you lose access to a key machine or your connection goes out. How do you recover from that? Do you have a backup? Where is that backup? You know, since the 90s, I think we've been trying to hammer this this point home. If you keep a backup, say for a local machine, something in your house, you don't keep the backup on top of that machine. You don't keep it even in the same house, because your house burns down, you lose everything. That's what happens. And so many people make that mistake, and so many companies make similar mistakes. So I think, you know, we keep seeing this reinforced over and over again, how to maintain good security, how to plan for that day when something is no longer there. Because that day will come. Every hard drive will fail. That is just a fact of life. I guess no one wants to debate that point. Okay.
No one wants to defend hard drives?
Okay, well, our last story for tonight. Do you remember we did a show last week, and we were talking about this service called Gab and how they got hacked? They got hacked again! Yes. A beleaguered social networking site Gab was breached on Monday, marking the second time in as many weeks that hackers have gained unauthorized access to a platform that caters to users pushing hate speech and pro-Trump conspiracy theories. The compromise came to light after someone hijacked the account of Gab founder and CEO Andrew Torba and left a post criticizing him for not paying an 8 Bitcoin ransom for the safe return of documents used to verify the identity of some users. First of all, I think that's the right thing, is not to pay people who are basically threatening you.
That's like 400 grand.
It's a lot of money, too. 8 Bitcoin is a lot of money. But that's the extent of which I'm going to defend their actions. The letter itself was kind of interesting. Where does it begin?
Who is the ransom for again?
It came from someone named Captain Jack Sparrow. We mentioned this last week. Which is a reference to the Pirates of the Caribbean character, Captain Jack Sparrow. Verified accounts on Gab were apparently compromised with a message from the hacker posted on their feeds. Dear Andrew, meaning Andrew Torba, one message apparently read, referencing the CEO of Gab. If you value transparency so much, why do you keep lying to your despicable users? This website has been fully compromised last week. 35 million public posts and 3 million private posts, 50,000 emails, 7,000 passwords, 831 verification documents. That's a reference to the Gab Leaks hack, which saw more than 70 gigabytes of data taken from the social media site. Gab users, your leaked verification documents are not even worth 8 bitcoins to them. They do not care about you or their 18,000 pro users. Don't worry about it. Well, you know, at this point, I would just say that if you are a Gab user, your information really isn't worth anything anymore, because it's not going to it's not going to remain private. It already is out there, and you have a better chance of getting it on the dark web than you do on Gab, because I don't think they have a handle on their service at all. Anybody surprised by this? Kyle, are you surprised?
Just keep watching what they say, I guess, as a user. I'm not sure if your customer service, you know, your responses are going to come back. I don't know what you would be saying as a customer now.
I don't know. Alex?
You know, one benefit of this to Gab users could potentially be if they lose their ID or, you know, if they're in a pinch somewhere, they need a copy of their driver's license, something like that. You know, they can just hop onto the dark web and buy it.
It's all there.
Cheaply.
It's all there. There's your backup. The dark web. How about that? The attacker who stole data from Gab harvested, how do you say this? Bearer tokens? It's not usually part of our day-to-day speak. During their initial attack, Torba wrote, though their ability to harvest new tokens was patched, we did not clear all tokens related to the original attack. By reusing these old tokens, the attacker was able to post 177 statuses in an eight minute period today. Gab's failure to purge bearer tokens may have stemmed from unfamiliarity with the open source Mastodon code the site runs, or an unwillingness to require users to go through the hassle of resetting their bearer tokens. The theft of the tokens came as a surprise to many because they weren't included in a trove of hacked Gab data posted by the WikiLeaks-style site Distributed Denial of Secrets following the breach. I think it's what's noteworthy here is that they never knew this data was obtained, at least not based on their reporting, said Troy Hunt, owner of the breach notification service Have I Been Pwned, referring to this notification that Gab posted on Saturday. Hunt said he was also surprised that Gab has yet to enforce a mandatory password reset for all users. Such resets are standard practice after sites experience breaches that compromise user data. You know, just looking at stories like this and seeing how they just keep getting into trouble doesn't seem like they're in the right line of work, you know? You have to take security seriously. They're in over their heads. I feel sorry for them. And for me to feel sorry for something like Gab... I know, you're shaking your head, Kyle. It's wrong to feel sorry, but I do. It feels like no matter what they do, they're going to do it wrong.
Well, their mishandling of it affects a lot of people, and they're not actually looking out for them, and that goes for exchange, you know, email, or whatever the case. There's businesses or institutions, patients... They're all affected when their information is swept up in an institution or corporate leak. And that's something we cannot forget in the midst of however we, you know, one or the other entity flounders in their handling of it.
Absolutely. Hey, we're out of time. We're going to continue this conversation on Overtime at 8 o'clock, channel 2600 on YouTube. Follow the link on 2600.com at the top of the page, and you can participate. You can call us, 802-321-HACK, 802-321-4225. We're off next week, back in 2 weeks for Off the Hook on WBAI. Continue listening. All kinds of amazing material on this radio station. And we will see you soon. Good night.
Bye.
You're tuned to Pacifica Radio, WBAI New York, and what follows is a message from Pacifica Radio's National Election Supervisor.
A proposed new set of bylaws is available for member review at pacifica.org.